Succession number 28361, reel 35.
General Julian Thompson, Reel 35. You were saying your Marines had a sort of respect for the IRA as a dangerous opponent.
Yes, the Marines respected them as dangerous people with whom you couldn't take tactical liberties. Mm. Otherwise you've got a bloody nose or worse. They didn't like them at all. I think you might almost say that they loathed them. But they respected them, yeah. Mm.
Did that run across Crosper Glen, Fork Hill, Bessbrook and Newry? Was it a sort of common thread in the...
Yes, it was a common thread. Mm. They respected them as people that, in the way you respect a rattlesnake or something like that. You didn't like it and you'd crush it if you possibly could.
Mm. But you would approach it carefully.
You'd approach it with care, yes.
Mm. So you don't... What view did they take of the Protestant population? Did they have any sympathy with them, or were they equally...
They didn't really have any great respect, I think, for the or sympathy for the Protestant population. I think partly because most of the contacts they had with them, and you never had contact with them in Crosman Glen or Fork Hill because they just didn't exist down there, was in Newry, and where they were trouble because they were whinging about the fact you weren't bashing the Catholics hard enough. Yeah. So I don't think they actually liked them either particularly.
Mm. Did you have anyone in the command who was from the province who might have been...
I'm just trying to remember who we had. We did, yes, because there were always a few Irishmen in command. And in fact, we may have even had some chaps from the south. I think we did.
Yeah. And the Republic's always been a good recruiting ground.
Yeah. And they were just like everyone else. Mm.
So could you say then that really the Marines were their patrimony as opposed to their place of origin?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The Marine was their home. Mm. You know, the Legion is my country.
Well, the Legion is rather special, though, isn't it? Because it's often a refuge from the land of stripy sunshine.
Yes, it is. But it's the same sort of attitude, I think, that your comrades were more important than the people outside the band.
Yeah.
Actually.
Mm. Yes, you're born into a family in which you choose your friends.
Yes. Mm. Yes.
So you got back to England. Where were you put then for your re-rolling?
We were back in our home barracks, Seaton Barracks outside Plymouth, which is quite handy because you're right by Dartmoor, so you've got training areas there. Mm. And we also had a little dry training area at the back where you could do minor tactics. Mm. The way I did my training was that I started with a series of toots, which I ran, which went down as far as corporal level, actually, in that I made the toots not just the company commanders, and what I did was the toots filtered down in the sense that I would give the company commanders a problem which they then had to solve. They would then give orders to their troop commanders, second commanders. So you had it went down through the chain of command. Yeah. And so we started with toots and we did advance to contact, advance, withdrawal, defence, other phases of war, and which largely we were able to do in our dry training era at the back, which was what I call normal countryside, and not bare-ass Dartmoor training area. Therefore, it was much more fun doing toots there. And we also used the married patch as the fibia toot and that sort of thing. Then we did what I call battle procedure drills, where the whole commando went out onto Dartmoor and we went through battle procedure, you know, how you move up to an FUP, how you cross the start line. No enemy. It only took a few hours, but you were getting back into the business of the articulation of the whole operating as a unit.
Field drills,
so that everybody knew what they had to do if they had to lay out the start line for a night attack or whatever. People knew how to do it. And then we did that by day and by night. And then we then had an exercise on Dartmoor where we did have a live enemy. So that's how I progressed it.
Did you provide your own enemy on that occasion?
We had to provide our own enemy because you know, everyone else was so busy. Mm. So we had to provide our own enemy. Yeah. And we went again through all the phases of war. Mm. We then took part in quite an interesting exercise where I was told I had to provide casualties to exercise the brigade medical organisation. And I thought, oh, that's a great bit of a bore. Mm. I then struck upon quite a good way of making the best of what would otherwise have been a bit of a waste of time, in that I doubled it up with an exercise, which I had, again, on Dartmoor with my own enemy. And what I did was, they wanted to practice Kazovac, and they wanted to be sort of flooded with casualties. They wanted lots of casualties.
Well, put ourselves under pressure.
And what I did was, I killed off all the leaders. And those, so they all had to go back and become casualties, and others as well. And as they were then released from the casualty organization, they didn't come back to me, they came part of the enemy. So the enemy got stronger and stronger. But what meant was that I found corporals as troop commanders and young second lieutenants commanding companies, which was tremendous value for them. And they had a hell of a lot of fun doing that.
How long did that go on for?
That went on for about 48 hours. It wasn't long. Yeah. But it was fun doing it. Mm. And what I did was that the only people I allowed to come back were the company commanders, and they were not allowed to run their companies. They became the company umpire. And the aim really was for them to see how their subordinates were operating in one or two or even three stages higher position than they would normally have had. And so everyone enjoyed themselves, because Marines found themselves as section commanders and things like that. And the final attack, which was a dawn attack, a commando attack, I mean, other than me and the coming commanders as umpires, the whole damn thing was run by second lieutenants and corporals.
How did they do? Did they do
very well? You know, had fun. So it was a good way of exercising the Kazovac thing and getting some benefit out of it as well.
How's the Kazovac actually done? Was it being done by stretcher bearers?
It was being done by stretcher bearers back to either helicopters or road ambulances, or I didn't actually get too involved in that bit. I got much more involved in having fun with all the corporals acting, you know, and doing jobs that were three stages above their heads.
Normally it's two up, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, they did two up, and I think one or two did three up.
Who on this occasion, the medical org, do you know if they thought they'd done well under the pressure of?
I didn't ask them, quite honestly. Yeah. I think they did, yes. Yeah.
Who decided what wounds they were having to cope with, presumably?
Well, what they had was they had, they brought down a team who were Royal Army Medical Corps, I think, who were a team of sort of, you know, dressers who put wounds on people. So, let's say we were doing a company attack as part of our exercise. Among them, the company, there'd be these guys who say, right, you've been hit, there, go to, and then they'd dress them up.
Yeah.
And then the Marines had a lot of fun, you know, sort of pretending to have broken legs and complaining and things like that, and saying, when are you going to take me away? And it was quite good practice for us, actually. But I didn't see the next bit, because perhaps I should have taken more interest in it. I was more interested in the other.
Mm. Well, that sounds like it was quite a creative use of an opportunity.
Yes.
Serve more than one purpose.
Yeah.
So you're getting them back into the swing of things by doing both toots, drills without enemy, then with enemy, and then this medical.
Yes. And then we did other exercises, and I can't remember which they all were. We did one using HMS Hermes as an LPH. She was actually an LPH at the time.
Yeah.
Can I just take this one?
Cool. You're saying that you use Hermes as an LPH for some of the training. Was this in?
This was. We did an exercise with Hermes.
Helicopter assault.
Just a helicopter assault. It was a very short one. A more interesting exercise, which I'll come on to in a minute, was one of the two things that I wanted to emphasise in this period was three things were getting our skills and drills for conventional war up to speed. Mm. Also shooting.
Yes.
Getting back, you know, ordinary shooting as opposed to the other kind. And so we did, we went to Hythe and did our shooting there rather than trying to do it locally, which was a complete waste of time.
Mm.
And then we then did an exercise called Exercise Whiskey Galore, 29 April to 8th of May, in the Outer Hebrides, which we did from two LSLs, and it was very much a sort of poor man's amphibious exercise, because the LSLs, of course, are not real amphibious ships in the sense that the LPDs are. Mm. We didn't have an LPH. But one thing we did have, which was quite fun, was we had a large hovercraft.
Had you used that sort of thing before?
I'd not used hovercraft before. I'd seen them being used when I was brigade major, but I'd not actually been in one myself. Mm. And this was a big hovercraft that was being trialled by the Navy. And you could get quite a lot of people into it.
Yeah.
You could get something like two companies plus into this thing.
Must be like one of those that they used as car transport.
Yes, it was a big car, and it was being used by the Navy, I think, experimentally, and it never came into service, sadly. Yeah. But it was a real winner when it came to actually getting around quickly at night, and particularly in those islands, and because it could take shortcuts across bits of beach that had been exposed by the tide.
Mm.
And you could land loads of guys very quickly.
No problem with offshore sandbags.
No problem with offshore sandbags. The problems were that because it was a commercial hovercraft, the ramp at the front wasn't big enough to get a lot of people out at once.
Mm.
And secondly, when the ramp went down, all the lights went on inside. So at night, it was rather bad for surprise.
Mm.
But we had quite a lot of fun doing a series of moves up and down the Outer Hebrides, and we covered quite a lot of ground.
Mm. Do you know why it was that we didn't actually adopt the hovercraft? Because the US Marine Corps did,
I think they found them very
useful, particularly in areas of low-lying coasts like Denmark. I think they used hovercraft very extensively.
Yes, I think it was we wanted to use them, and we'd been involved for a long time with hovercraft, because we'd had chaps in the experimental hovercraft group that went to the Falklands and Borneo and all over the place. But for years we sort of fiddled about with hovercraft. But they never, I don't think the Navy liked them very much, because they were sort of not proper boats. No one else wanted them because they couldn't see any use for them in BAOR.
Mm.
And one has to remember that the four armour divisions in BAOR were the sort of jewel in the crown of the defence establishment in the 1960s and 70s, weren't they?
They were. One would imagine they might have been quite useful for river crossings.
They could have been, but people were not. Sometimes people get a sort of thing. They just don't. They now have hovercraft, I might say. We now have them, but nothing like that size, not even like as fast.
Yes.
And yes, you're quite right, the American Marines use them, but we never really picked it up.
Mm.
Sadly, we should have done, I think.
So we picked up ideas about landing craft and LPHs from the Americans, didn't we, after Suez?
Yes,
and
we did. We did. But we didn't.
So you were discussing that, you know, that a narrow field of view rather excluded the hovercraft, or it might have been really useful.
Yes.
And it wasn't acquired sufficiently.
It didn't. It never had enough backing within the establishment.
Yes.
The defence establishment to attract funds to keep it going.
Mm.
It was just, you know, one of those nice to have but not essential, I think, is how they regarded it.
That sounds more like a matter of politics than.
Well, I think it is.
Else.
I think it is. Yeah. I think it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you doing any exercises at brigade level at this stage, or
primarily your
commando getting itself back in?
Yes, the brigade level exercise was this thing we did with the LPH. I'm now looking at here. It turns out it was a brigade level exercise, but it wasn't in the sense that we were the only people on the ground, as it were.
Yeah.
Brigade headquarters took part in order to give themselves a run through, It was on Dartmoor, and we use the helicopter. It was a pretty short one, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. Didn't last long.
What was the role at this stage then? Was it reinforcement of the flanks as it had been before?
Yeah. I mean, we were reinforcement of the flanks. So all our settings were NATO settings. So, for example, this exercise we did, which was called Forest Venture, where we were using Hermes. The setting of the exercise was that Devon and Cornwall represented a NATO country in Northern Europe in summer, threatened by a Warsaw Pact neighbour.
Yep.
No guesses for which country it was.
Indeed.
In Northern Europe, and it was the summer, because it actually happened to be summer.
Mm.
And then we did, and then there was a brigade training period rather than a brigade exercise, which was 2 weeks on Salisbury Plain, I see, in September.
What's the difference between a training period and an exercise?
Well, they didn't. There was no formation exercise to the degree that the brigade didn't fight a battle in quotation marks as a brigade. What happened was that we practiced various things that we were unable to practice elsewhere, like, for example, infantry armour cooperation on Salisbury Plain. The anti-tank guns, the mortars were firing on the ranges. We were able to do support by artillery and all the sort of combined arms things that were more difficult. You could do them on Dartmoor. You couldn't have tanks on Dartmoor, for example. By using Salisbury Plain, by having exclusive use of the plane, you could actually do a lot of stuff, a lot of fibula, close quarter battle, armour, infantry cooperation, etc. What else did we do? We did raiding training. That was something else that we wanted to do, which is companies were sent down to Cornwall to operate with small boats climbing cliffs and doing raiding, sort of buffing up our sort of commando skills doing that. And then we did two exercises with at Warminster, where the company commanders course, or the all-arms combat team commanders course, whatever they called it then, was always looking for battalions to volunteer to be the guinea pigs for their chaps to command.
Oh, right.
So that the demonstration battalion could act as enemy.
Oh.
And so what one did was you stripped out all your commanders.
Yes.
Down to and including troop commander.
Oh.
So that the students took the part of the CO, 2IC, as you know, all the sort of commander, the company commander, and probably the troop commander as well. And then what we did, the way we played it, was that we all became Marines or private soldiers. So I was a Marine in a rifle company. You know, I stripped my rank badges off and became a Marine in B company.
Hmm.
So that you weren't sort of handing your chaps over to these strangers without taking part in the thing itself yourself.
Did the strangers know that they had got the?
They knew that among them.
Yes.
That were people.
Hmm.
It was quite fun. Of course, a lot of the DS on the course, who were one's contemporaries, knew you and come around and laugh with you as you were digging your slip trench on Salisbury Plain. I shared a slip trench with a Stormman of B Company, I remember. And but it was actually quite good training because it enabled, again, it was this business of enabling your section commanders who suddenly find themselves commanded by strange people, so they actually had to take more responsibility onto themselves. And I think the proudest moment in my life at that stage was when afterwards I actually had to leave the exercise because there was a panic. It looked as if we might have to all go to Belize.
Well,
so as we were walking along a hedge, I remember, about to do a company attack, and at that stage we were all wearing our respirators and we were all kitted out completely in our sort of NBC kit. and a worried looking DS from Monmouth came along the line saying to the Marines, "Where's your commanding officer? Where's commanding officer?" So they all pointed at me. And so I stripped my mask. He said, you're needed on the radio. Yeah. So I went to the radio and I had to come out of the exercise. And when I got back, a chap said to me, "Your chaps are very well trained, because we had to do a battalion night attack, and one of your corporals was able to lay out the FUP with all the right lights for a battalion night attack." And I thought, well, I've achieved something anyway. Yeah. So those were quite good value, because it enabled the chaps to work with APCs and armour, doing something you wouldn't normally have done unless you've been able to muscle your way in onto the plane under the guise of helping out the School of Infantry.
How did the students do on the whole, Warminster students?
They were okay. Yeah. And I didn't get any complaints from any of them. And they were pretty closely supervised by the DS. Because I think the DS realised that if they buggered too many battalions about, there wouldn't be many commanding officers who volunteered their command chaps to come back. We did it twice.
Mm. Were they doing it at company level or right up to?
No, it was right up to battalion level. The other thing we did at that stage was take part in Silver Jubilee celebrations in London.
What happened to Bailey's Panic? Did it subside or?
Oh, that subsided, sadly.
It was a false alarm then.
It was a false alarm. It was something to do with. It was that period when. Was it Guatemala?
Yes, it was the Guats.
The Guats were always threatening to invade. Yes. And that was one of these moments when they stuck their head above the parapet and said, "We're about to invade you." So they looked as if they were going to have to reinforce Belize. I think in those days there was a battalion there. So it looked as if they needed a second battalion. But it all died away and never happened.
Mm. That seems to have been a recurrent pattern in
Bailey's,
that
yes, it was.
Every so often there is an apparent threat that never actually materialises, because there's usually a response.
Yeah. Mm. So we did street lining in Fleet Street and Ludgate Hill. I walked four companies and colours and band. Because the Royal Marines are allowed to march through the city with band, the drums playing and colours flying and bayonets fixed. Yeah. So we exercised our privilege of doing that. I had not one band, but two.
It's a bit lavish. One at the front and one at the back.
We had to split. Yes. We had to come out of a place where we formed up, and one lot went up Ludgate Hill and the other went up Fleet Street. We were continuous, so we had to have a band to take that, not a band to take that, so we had two.
So bands marching in two directions at once,
all hoping that everyone was in step. Anyway, the weather was cool and overcast, I read here, and the rain never fell. And it was quite fun. Little interlude. And the final event that year, and I'm whipping through 1977 quite quickly, was of course Operation Burberry, from 14th of November to the 19th of January, which was the Farman strike.
Had you had warning of that eventuality?
Not much. I had been ordered to send a company to join the Commando Logistic Regiment, who were in Birmingham, the West Midlands, but I didn't think that we were going to be sent. And suddenly I got a phone call to say that the Royal Highland Fusiliers, because it went on longer than expected, the Royal Highland Fusiliers, I just shut the door. Royal Highland Fusiliers were going to Northern Ireland, and therefore had to start their Northern Ireland training. And because it was, by then I suppose the thing had been going on for about a week, or maybe slightly longer, it didn't look like ending. They had to be relieved. So we were flown up from Plymouth, and I picked up some other people as well. I picked up a company from another commando, a couple of companies from the Duke of Edinburgh's Royal Regiment, as they were then, a squadron of armour from the Royal Scots Dragoon Guards, as they were then, and a sprinkling of other people, totally about 1,200 guys.
So you've got about six or seven companies.
Six or seven companies worth. And I took over the Strathclyde patch from the Royal 100 Fusiliers, and the Strathclyde patch.
That includes Glasgow, doesn't
it? What was then known as the tinderbox of Europe, as the media in their inimitable fashion called it. And it stretched from Helensburgh in the north down to Ayr in the south and to Prestwick. Now, a lot of the area was covered by... do you want me to go into detail on this?
Yes.
A lot of the area, the rural area, was covered by the volunteer fire brigades who weren't on strike, because it was mainly the conurbations one was worried about. Though I had this huge area, you know, Campbelltown, even out to the islands, I think Isla. I didn't have to bother about that, because that was all looked after by the
local auxiliaries.
Yeah, the real nub of it was Glasgow.
Yeah.
Which, as I say, the press in their emotional way called the tinderbox of Europe and were forecasting, you know, terrible things happening. Anyway, I arrived ahead of, in the usual way, with my advance party ahead of my chaps, marched it to see the GSE Scotland in the castle in Edinburgh, who's Lieutenant General Wobbly Scott Barrett, of later the Scots Guards, expecting a full briefing on the whole problem of firefighting in Scotland. His sole words to me were, "The dram is bigger in Scotland." So that was my briefing.
Had your chaps with the Commando Logistic Regiment done any training in firefighting?
No.
Because at that time the army still had its own fire brigade, didn't it? It's part of the Ordnance Corps.
That's right. What we did was, the way we did it, we flew to Redford, because there was no barracks in Glasgow in those days. There was no, well, there still isn't. There was no military barracks in Glasgow. The only military sort of toeholds in Glasgow were TA centres. But the great... Highland Light Infantry Barracks in Mary Hill had been knocked down many years before. So the only way to stage was to stage in Red Hill Barracks in Edinburgh, Redford Cavalry Barracks in Edinburgh. And this actually became our sort of rear echelon and our transit camp. So the whole commando flown out to Edinburgh, then moved, and the vehicles drove up, and then we staged from there to Glasgow, and we had to take over 16 locations in Strathclyde, which were in a mixture of sort of drill halls, old chapels, secondary schools, you name it, but not the fire stations, because, you know, they were forbidden territory. The distance from the northwesterly stations to the most southeasterly was 45 miles in a straight line, and our nearest the nearest station from Redford Barracks, our administrative base, was 50 miles. That was my sort of echelon.
Your area.
My echelon. And what we then did at Redford was one day's training on how to use the kit.
What kit did you have?
Well, we had the Green Goddesses. Do you want to come in and do the windows? Yeah, come.
I think you were saying you had the Green Goddess as your base.
We had the Green Goddess was the basic bit of kit. Mm. And it was actually quite a good fire engine, I'm told, by those that know these things.
Rather elderly, by that sort.
Rather elderly, though. But it worked. Mm. I did various things in that I rechanged the way they laid everything out, the way the jocks had done it. And I grouped the fire stations into forces, as it were.
Yes.
So two or three fire stations came under one company commander. Mm. It's been rather ad hoc up to that moment. Mm. And the fire control was actually at Pitt Street Police Station, which is the Strathclyde headquarters, where they had a computer, which was really state-of-the-art in those days. Mm. And unlike the fire brigade, and I gather they were exactly the same this last time around, the fire brigade run their own op centres. They don't have combined op centres with the police and the emergency service. It's absolutely ludicrous, really. But we had a combined op centre.
Does that mean you had police, fire and ambulance all under your hand?
Yeah. And the actual deployment wasn't my... I wasn't commanding the tactics of it in the sense that there'd be a fire in place X. This would come to the police, to Pitt Street, who would then deploy... the FAR fighters from whatever the nearest FAR station was, or if they were all out, they would come from another one.
Yeah.
And then what happened was a police car would lead the Green Goddess crew to the FAR